So that tells you how it is.
Slip, huh?
A little bit. Might have to leave that one in.
You have to.
Yeah.
No.
No, editing that out, man. That stays.
Hold up. Before we jump into it, I just wanted to take a brief moment and share some thoughts. Definitely skip forward if you like. A minute or two should do it. Anyway, obviously the beast of politics might be the topic of the day, but there's a core problem I wanted to touch on that goes beyond left and right. It's the hate out there, which is a hell of a lot more real than this national circus. You know what I'm talking about. We've all been seeing it, and it's not new. It is, however, much more bold today. And I'm the kind of person, I could rant about this for hours. I'm definitely primed to, and many of you who know me are nodding your heads in agreement. But that's not my intention in this opening. Frankly, we're probably going to get into it during the show. I just wanted it out there in the front, so it's in the front of your mind. There's always going to be assholes and racists and bigots on our buses, in the stores, on the street. I'm just saying, we're photographers, right? We record life. Let's use that skill to fight back. Now, knowing our listener base out there, it's very unlikely this is news to any of you, and I'm probably preaching to the choir. Hell, most of us run toward the danger, don't we? I just thought it's still worth bringing up, you know? If you see someone being harassed, be careful, but step in if you can. And if not, we can still record these monsters as they rage on, and then, you know, show the world. Another thing for everyone out there, particularly the photojournalists and reporters, it's probably going to get pretty weird and pretty tough before things shift again. Paranoia is growing, silence is creeping, and there's a lot of folks who don't want the world to see their true face. So I ask that we all be a bit more careful as well. So, yeah, that's all I wanted to say. We're all people. Let's watch the backs of our people and our own. And that's not too much for us to ask each other, is it? Cheers, and let's get on with the show. With that out there, I think it's a good transition that we jump right into the heart of why we're here with our guest today. Well, actually, before that, I'm so sorry. I need to say who we even are. I'm Casper.
And I'm Jim.
And this is Street PX. You're listening to episode number 28.
Wow.
Yes. So, sorry about that, folks. I just had to get that out there. Now it's time to kind of get some energy going.
No, it's all right. You know, because you've been in the thick of things.
Yes.
You and our esteemed guest have been in the thick of things. And you've seen a lot. You've seen those protests in Oakland. You guys both have experienced it firsthand online as photojournalists. And that's important. That's important that it's documented. And if you got something on your chest, let it out.
Hey, we got a platform here. We might as well.
That's right.
Just one quick plug. New for Street PX is our merchandise store, now live. We have 24 really awesome new designs. All have been cooking in the studio for the last few weeks now. And this is ranging from branding to photography-related artwork. We even have a new line of designs being built that's going to continue to expand. It's these camera schematic painting things. It's really kind of a neat take on your favorite cameras from old and new. And you'll find Leica M1s, Leica M4, Minolta, Nikon. We even have an Olympus Stylus and a Ricoh GR, amongst many others. And more to be added, if you have one in mind, something that you prefer to carry, or was maybe like your first camera or something, let us know. Shoot us an email, and we'll cook one up and drop it in there. And take a look at our website. That's where it's going to be at streetpx.com. Also, everything that we're getting from this goes right back into the show, just like our Patreon account, which is another place that you can contribute. That's at patreon.com/streetpx. And I think even the $20 contribution will get you a free shirt. So, you know, buy into that, select it, and we'll send it.
That's right.
But Jim, I'm gonna throw it to you and have you introduce our esteemed guest here.
Well, we have Wassam Al-Badri, who is an esteemed photojournalist and
documentary photographer.
Documentary photographer. And we're just glad to have him here. Welcome, man.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Casper. I'm blushing over here if you can see it. Thank you for the kind words. It's a pleasure to be with you guys. Oh, man. I really get happy when I see other journalists and documentarians and general photographers. That's the only time I get wooed. You know? Like, I'll meet painters and I'll meet all these amazing, you know, artists, and I'll be like, oh, cool. But when I meet another photographer, I'm always like, you know, yeah. Hey, guys.
Now it's time for some shop talk, right?
Yeah. It's like, yeah, well, you know,
yeah, we've got a lot to talk about.
Yeah. Yes, we do. You would tell the people a little bit about yourself, yeah, and just kind of start it off really quickly.
Well,
that way.
Currently I live in San Francisco. My background is documentary work and photojournalism. I'm very interested in extended photo essays. That's my thing. There's times when I submit work and they want an image or two and I refuse to send in the work. I was like, you're taking away from the whole story. Mm-hmm. But so I'm originally from Iraq. I was born in Iraq in 1984. 1991, first Gulf War, Iraq invaded Kuwait. There was an uprising in the south and there was an uprising in the north of Iraq. So I'm from the southern part of Iraq, Nasiriyah. There was an uprising. It was the last stronghold in Iraq, you know, to fight Saddam. It was close to the marshes. And so we tried a few times to flee the country. First two times were not successful. Third time was successful, and this is with all my mother, four siblings at that time, three brothers, and my newborn sister. She was like, by the last time we made it successfully, she was about a week and a half old. So the story goes on, and then I spend about 4.5 years in a refugee camp. I think a lot of my political view of the world or understanding of the world, you know, being around a lot of, I mean, everybody from different walk of life. The first 2 years in the refugee camp was considered a prisoner of war's camp because Saudi Arabia never signed with the United Nations to take in refugees. Mm-hmm. So we were treated as that. Now, don't get me wrong, they were kind. Okay, so I want to throw that out there. You know, just like they didn't know 40-some thousand people going to cross into the border. You know, like they were freaking out as much as everybody else. Then we crossed the border and people were demanding, like, you know, we want, you know, to be recognized, because people thought that we'll go back home in a week, right? Then a month.
Thought it would all blow over.
Yeah. And- yeah. Then 6 months, then a year, then 5 years, then 10 years, then 18 years, right? There's people who spent, they went back in 2004 from 1991 to 2004. Mm. I mean, you can only imagine if I added up my math right. There were kids who were born there.
Yeah.
You know, and that they didn't know what else. And they were like nomads because they were not Saudi citizens and they were not Iraqi citizens. So they were just like in this, you know, like up in the air, like where are they going to go? They were recognized by the United Nations as displaced civilians, same as myself. So that would be the story. So like going back, a lot of my activist work or my political views or my shaping of the world came from that, you know, growing up around a lot of people, you know, who had, strong political opinions and views and how they wanted to make things better. But everybody that I grew up around didn't want to pick up a gun or use their fist. They always wanted them, you know, find an alternative to how to make things better. Now there were who chose to do that.
Yeah.
And everybody deals with the struggle different. You know, we all make different exposures. So
yeah,
people have their own way of, you know, dealing with the world. And so then that's how I got introduced to photojournalism. I wanted to be a writer at first. Didn't go too well. It wasn't like, well, I wasn't like, you know, I was in second grade, right? So, but I had to, I remember in the refugee camp, I made me a makeshift like table, and I started writing and reporting. Then, but I was like, no, photography is better, you know, because I'm a more of a visual person.
Okay.
And, so I started, and that's like the story that, I've been asked about, how I acquired my first camera. And it was a trade off all my life till today. I'm always trading off with people because sometimes, you know, we will live in a world you always have to pay something monetary, but I think there's something beautiful when you trade something off. I mean, you know, sometimes you get the best value and sometimes you don't, but
well, you're talking about something that has value, personal items. Yeah. These actually have sentimental value. Yeah.
They do. And that's how I traded off my first camera. I hate button up shirts. Yeah,
I mean, look down, make sure you didn't have one on.
No, I usually do, but I don't button them up. It makes me dislike something, you know. I don't understand either a t-shirt or no t-shirt, but don't like make me button up.
You know? So not a fan of what I've got on.
I'm cool. No, I have a lot. I just never button them, you know. And I had marbles, and kids used to play marbles a lot, but I never had good aim, you know. Pop, you know, it wasn't my thing, and so I traded off a kid for a camera. And, I didn't understand nothing. I mean, like, you know, some people said my uncle gave me my first camera and that's how I started my career. I didn't understand anything of it. I just wanted to shoot. Now, I didn't have no film. I was just going around shooting. You know, I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
Like, to photograph, and people were posing and I was reading books like, oh, you know, people wrote books about images they wish, you know, they have made or created. And I was like, yeah, I think I should have done that too. But, you know, but that kept that drive going.
Right.
And,
the process.
Yeah. The process of wanting to be all of that. And like, you know, and I think photography is a beautiful thing. And with all respect to all photographers out there, we're all the same. I mean, like, it don't matter if you do street photography, fashion photography, documentary. I think the divide we're always trying to say, we all do the same thing. We all have, we all create.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the most important thing that unites us. We all create work. Mm-hmm. And some people, you know, always like, you know, I'm in an art school and they're like, oh no, journalism and documentary. No, we're conceptual in theory. And I was like, that's cool too. But at the end, you still create an image.
Right.
So
still need the technical background. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And there's some people who never, you know, they're like, they never had experience. They just know how to write about it.
Right.
And, you know, so everybody, you know, deals with photography different. And I think you guys both do street photography also.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something I can't do. I'm just throwing that out there. Cause it's like, you know, it's a whole different, you know, when I do journalism and documentary, with journalism, there is a story out there, right?
Right.
So I know I can go photograph it.
You have something that, yeah, a goal there, in mind.
Yeah, it's like, it's like in a way, it's theater. Things are happening, right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So you learn how to see that. Documentary, I have a week, 6 months, 4 years to work on a story. But a street photographer is not like that.
Right.
You know, it's that like flop. You know,
mm-hmm.
And that's why I told myself next semester, I'm going to spend the whole like 4 months just photographing street photography. Because can you imagine doing like a combination of street and documentary work and those moments you get to read? Because, you know, I think journalists and photographers or documentarians, we process, then we click the shutter.
Right.
But street, you don't have time to process.
That's right.
The eye, the shutter, you know.
It's happening before you're registering.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And that's something I envy. So I'm just saying, like, you know, it's like, if I can get that, it would shift my whole work.
We need to get him out there with us.
Man. We do. Still, we do.
Yeah.
From a street photographer's perspective, somebody that does mostly street is going to look at documentary work or a photojournalist in a very similar light as, you know, the way I do it, this works for me and this is easy for me, but I can't understand how you XYZ fill in the gap here, you know.
I see that. And I believe that, you know, we all read light,
mm-hmm.
and hats off to street photographers because they, you know, y'all read light on the,
you live light
faster than the meter can process it, you know, and I'm interning for a newspaper currently, and they send me out to photograph the tower that's sinking in San Francisco.
Oh,
Millennium Tower.
And I was there, and I seen these five people standing there in suits, and the light was just bouncing off the ground into their face, you know? And you guys probably see that all the time.
Oh, yeah.
But that was, for me, was an aha moment. I was like, yeah, I'm gonna do street photography.
Now, for the listeners out there that's not from the Bay Area, really, I just want to kind of allude something because it's, we have a one of our large skyscrapers out here was, let's say, poorly planned.
Yeah. Yes, I would say so. You know,
that's an understatement.
At the very foundation of it,
quite literally.
Yeah, literally.
Oh,
yeah.
Look at this man! But no, it is actually sinking, and it's a problem that San Francisco's dealing with, but. Would that, wait a minute, a sinking building in San Francisco or something sinking, is that a symbolism for something?
I'm not going there.
Sorry.
Because you can get real political with that.
Oh, yeah. Okay, we already started out that way. Yeah.
That's true. Let's keep it going.
Let's keep it going.
But, you know, it's interesting that you say that you look at street photographers and wonder, because I'm the other way.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a street photographer, but I look at documentary photographers.
But you guys already have that.
But I love the way documentary photographers develop stories over time.
But see, you guys think, so I think in a boxing metaphor is that your guys like Tyson. Uh-huh. One punch knockout, and we want to be like Ali. No, really, you know, like loop. And I have friends who do street photography, but what it is, I think street photographers don't give their time. Like, if you go out there and say, I'm just, you know, a lot of people who've been given major exhibitions, they just said, I'm going to photograph for 6 months this subject downtown, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they literally do that. And I have a friend of mine, he's in doing his grad. He just went downtown for like 4 months. You know, and just photograph people standing real close, plop, 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 made a body of work.
Mm-hmm.
You, and I seen your work. You have not a body of work, not 10 bodies of work. You have over maybe 30 bodies of work. I was like, what is this guy? I was like, does he even take a break?
You know? Jim doesn't. No, Jim's prolific as they come.
But, and so you have, I think what we do is we shoot like y'all, but I think we get put the time to construct a story because visually you have it. Technically y'all have it. So what I think is that taking moment to yourself now and putting the story together, you know, and I think that's what it is.
And I would love to do that.
Yep.
You know, that's what I strive to do.
And the other thing is that you guys work in the one click mentality. Uh-huh. We don't.
Many.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, the other night in Oakland when we were talking, like my goal is I shoot in twos. Some people, you know, that's my habit. When I see a subject, I just, my finger, you know, like click and I'm moving a click, right? Then I go on with my business.
It's funny. I do exactly the same thing. Every shot I take is a double down.
Yeah. And you know, some people are like, no, I was like, look, whatever works, whatever floats your boat, that's your business. And I seen this guy with a Canon 1DX too. So I look at people cameras. I nerd out. I was like, oh, what do you got? And it was spray and pray. I mean, he was in the middle of the protest, and all I heard was like,
get that 9 frames per second just rolling.
Yeah, and like, so I went up to him, I was like, hey, buddy, you should let that buffer, like, you know, like, let it buffer, like, let it
chill. Let your camera catch up with you.
Yeah, he didn't say a single word to me. And I was like, what's the point? I was like, then how are you telling the story? I mean, like.
Well, let me ask you this. From what perspective are you doing the double down, the you know, shutter each time? Is there a particular reason for it? Is it just habit?
No, my favorite number is 2.
Oh.
I don't like to be number 1. I know that sounds ridiculous.
Because 2 is not a winner and 3 is not remembered, right?
Yeah, 2 is cool. Like, nobody bothers you.
Uh-huh.
You get your work out, but you don't get bugged, you know? Yeah. You'll be relevant. But, you know, and I felt that one time and I didn't like that feeling.
Uh-huh.
And even since I was a kid, that was my favorite number. But I think in 2 is 2 things happen with me. First time, they acknowledge you.
Mm-hmm.
They don't expect you to take that photo again. Then I click it again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like, I like that. And 2, sometimes because people move in protests and all of that, that it becomes a theater. So if you can read body language, you know, like you see people, like the other day, somebody ran up with masks. So I got the first shot, him, you know, having him in there, his hand, and everybody ran toward him to grab one. So I got the second one, you know, and that looked more dramatic in the sense of like everybody, and they didn't know each other, but they all had a role to play.
Mm-hmm.
Now there is people who shoot in threes, but I think it became a habit also because I was cheap. I used to shoot film and I didn't, once I went to do this project for 2 weeks and I shot 11 rolls. Nobody talked to me again who wanted that photo. So, you know, they were upset. They're like, how much work you got for us? And I came back all proud, you know?
300-400 frames.
Yeah, and they're like, okay. And I submitted 20 and they took them, you know, they were happy. But at the same time, I was like, I cheated myself in a way because there is so much I did not want to photograph because I was thinking, I have five more shots.
Oh, you're left. Worried about the frames.
Yeah. I was like, I have five more frames. And how am I gonna, like, what if something interesting happened and digital democratize?
Yes.
The way we see the world. I mean, I have one of my really close friends. I'm trying to convince him, but he built a career shooting film. He won't come to digital, but I was like, yo, you're going around with like 50 rolls to 100 rolls every freaking event when, you know, something he get mm-hmm. good. And I was like, then you spend 2 months developing.
Mm-hmm.
Then you spend this, you know. But I mean, once you build that name, I think you have that time to do it.
You know? Plus, you have a bit of a reputation that it's, you know, you're building it on. For me, exactly. I mean, I like film, because it's like more of a meditation. Now my two shot structure that is similar to yours, it doesn't translate over into film because I'm also extremely cheap, and that just like 36 turns into what, 16, 17, I don't know, math, 18. But for me, the two shot is because blinking.
Yep.
That's the main reason why I agree. Two shot.
And so I do break that rule. Don't get me wrong. If there's a big ass crowd of people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's always somebody yawning, somebody closing their eyes.
That's the thing. So that's why I'm always shooting twice. One of those two shots, you know, because I don't know how many great images I have in my archives where the light's perfect, the scene is wonderful, and I clicked it once, and what happened? Like you said, somebody.
You need to do art then. You need to come to art school because that would be totally accepted.
And I kind of do the same thing, although I don't have a set number of shots, you know, but it's the way I feel. If I feel I might miss something, you know, I'll wrap out two or three or four shots, you know.
Mm-hmm. And some of them people say, shoot like you can't shoot again. I mean, like, you're not going to get, let's say you get an assignment to St. Quentin. Right? To do a story, and you got one day. You're not gonna go in there with 10 rolls.
No, and you might not, you don't wanna go back either.
So. No. But that's the thing. And a friend of mine, he's like, I shoot like I'm not gonna shoot there tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And if a place give you access, let's say, I don't know, to the RNC or DNC, and you got one day pass, you're not gonna show up there like trying to look all cool. Me with 10 rolls of film, you know, trying to impress nobody, you know, but myself.
But we're in a world that you don't have to. The technology is there.
Uh-huh.
And
I know what you mean.
I'm just
thinking what you're missing when you're changing film over.
Right.
And let
me
be very clear. I love film. I still shoot black and white.
All of us
You know, I taught classes over the summer that's black and white. I'm a nerd. I mean, you can write me and you can like, I have my own little system about filming everything, developing it, you know, and all of that. So I respect film. Now, if it's a personal project and I have time, I'll do film.
Mm-hmm.
And if I want to eat, I'm shooting digital.
There's the key.
There is no other thing. You know, that's the truth.
Well said.
Yeah.
Now, I don't mean to digress back to kind of early on, but. Yeah. We had started off, you were talking about being a refugee coming through the camp in Saudi Arabia. I was curious, can you expand on that a little bit?
It's an experience that a lot of us don't want to discuss. And it's an experience, I just want to make it very, like, it's not any different from all that's happening with people across, you know, crossing to Europe, Central Asia. There's a lot of issues happening. Africa, there's a lot of issues happening. Latin America. You know, and even in America, the prisons. So I just want to be very clear. All our story, and I keep saying this, is the reason is you're hearing my story because I got an opportunity to tell it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mine is not that more important in any way than anybody else's.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. So I'm just like, want to be very clear that we all struggle and and if you're listening across in that sense, that We all struggle in a way more than another. So
it's not an isolated story.
Yes. Yeah. So I spent 4.5 years that basically I grew up. So we left Iraq. We were not like a rich family. We were not, you know, so we saw an opportunity, you know, dictator is hard to overthrow. You know, our town was the last town. You were facing death, you know, so it was. Execution field, the famous Kamakalali execution fields, you know, all of that. That was my hometown. I witnessed, you know, minivans, you know, with young men blindfolded going out to execution fields at a young age. I think if I was 12, 11, it would have been a whole different conversation. I would probably be sitting here having it with you. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, we got to the refugee camp. My mother pretty much saved all our lives. So we spent 4.5 years there. It was in the middle of a desert. So it was because we were not allowed to enter the country. Now, Kuwaiti refugees were allowed to be in Saudi Arabia, which made more sense because Iraq also was aggressive to Saudi Arabia. You know, we also bombed Saudi Arabia. So they didn't know. And, the refugee camp was a mixture of, you know, professors, doctors, Marxist, you know, religious people, you know, every walk of life, prisoners of war, criminals, and the majority were families. But, you know, everybody kept their own little sections in the camp. And that's, you know, you learn when I said a lot about humanity and a lot about, sharing and a lot about, empathy and solidarity. You learned it there at a young age because even though it's a really horrible condition, people learn to come together and unite and work together, you know. And that's what I learned, you know, at a young age is that if you're going to say something, say it. You know, if you're going to do something, do it. Don't cheat people in the sense of, so, you know, you grow up with that and you always have, we all have political views, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, right, and at a young age, I always had a big mouth. I mean, I was never afraid to, you know, say what I want to say or... Then I came, you know, then a name got picked in a lottery. Now I'm shortchanging y'all on the story completely. So, but you, over time, you'll ask more questions and yeah. I'll answer them.
But so, there was actually, sorry, but there's a lottery.
A lottery. So there was, a United Nations, convoy of, immigration officers who were interviewing people to come to different countries. So it's the United States, Canada, France, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, England. Everybody wanted Norway. I mean, that was like hands down. Everybody's like, I want to go to Norway, you know? and I think there was few more I'm missing.
So was this a randomized thing?
Yeah. My biological uncle and his family went to Holland.
Mm-hmm.
And, 4 months before us, and we got chosen to go to the United States. Our name, it's a long process, you know. I mean, like, you have to interview for 3-4 months, and, you know, fingerprints. I mean, you go through the whole night. Like, yeah. People think the technology they see today with immigration, that was in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're seeing is nothing new, you know. So, but we got sponsored by Catholic Social Services as refugees, and we had a relative here already. So we moved to the Midwest, Nebraska, which I call home, even though they voted red. But Lincoln and Omaha were blue. So,
oh, yeah. Exactly.
So I'm happy about that. I would have called up my friends and be like, what are y'all thinking? I mean, you know, and my whole family is U.S. citizens too, mm-hmm. except, you know, for me, and I'll get into that in a bit.
Yes, we need to get into that here shortly.
And so I moved here. I grew up in the Midwest. I did not know when I first came here. I was struggling. Well, when I came here in sixth grade. So you got to understand that I didn't have an education. I had an understanding of cultural education of mm-hmm. the world, right? So I was ahead of my peers in understanding the world. But education-wise, I learned to read and write Arabic fluently. At a young age, but there was a big gap. So I came here in sixth grade, and all I wanted to do was play soccer because I saw grass, and I was like, hey, that's what they do in real soccer fields.
This is what grass is for, right? Yeah.
The PE teacher, you give me a basketball, I kick it. Give me a football, I'll kick it. Give me a baseball, I was like too small and it hurts, you know? And there was a large community, you know? So we were the first... Iraqi refugees, mm-hmm. or Arabic speaking refugees that they didn't have a program for us because, you know, we just came from a war. So they were ahead of us. They were, Vietnamese students. So the Vietnamese community been here for a while. Then the Sudanese community came, then the Somalis, then Serbians, Bosnians. So it started building over time, but most of us didn't speak English, but we all understood two things. soccer and communicating with each other by hand gestures, you know, because we were, and those friendships still till today. That's why I get access to certain places, you know, to do certain stories, because those were my childhood friends or my brother's childhood friends or my sister's. So when I want to go somewhere and I'll be like, hey, who do you know in Kentucky? And my sister's like, well, my friend was with me a kid, and I'll contact them. Then I'll just show up and work there.
The power of networking.
Of course. And everybody needs that.
Yes.
You know, you can be the best photographer. I don't want my work to be seen when I'm dead, okay?
Yeah.
Because right. Nobody going to have the chance to tell me how much of a horrible photographer I was, right. You know?
You don't want to be a star when your dust is going toward them.
Yeah, you know? And I'd rather you tell me to my face, you know, than I'm like, you know, checking out or checked out.
But it is true. It's who you know.
Yeah, of course. Oh, no. I mean, we can catch on that later. So... So high school hit, and Tupac was around, Biggie was around, Bone Thugs and Harmony, and I was like, yeah, you know. I mean, later on, I got into Wu-Tang and them, but I wanted the hardcore, like, you know.
Yeah.
That's what I this is the American culture I understood, you know.
I still remember it was the World War album. It's like a dual or a triple disc.
Which one? Pox?
Bone.
Oh, Bone Thugs and Harmony. Yeah. Then I was in there. I love Snoop. I know y'all, Snoop is your boy here in California.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I was more of a, Cube, you know, Ice Cube and, Easy. So I just want to give a riff.
you know, I'm from Chicago and Snoop was my guy.
Oh, anyway. No. Yep. Do or Die. Yeah. Twister?
Yeah. Twister,
yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. See, there you go. Yes. Yeah, there we go.
I'm a little older for that, yeah. But you, yeah, still, no, you know, I remember,
growing up, do you want to ride, you know? Uh-huh. And I was like, this is the life, you know, because as a teenager, and if any teenager listening out there, we don't think years ahead. We only think what's happening tomorrow, who to impress, right? And that's what it is that you're in that, you know, in that life stage. I'm not going to catch on who I liked as R&B because I want to keep sounding cool, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, then you go through, progress through stages, and it hit me around senior year PTSD start kicking in. Because a lot of them, because in the 90s, children were not diagnosed with PTSD. Yeah. You know, it was nothing for children who witnessed war to understand PTSD. Parents were like, well, you act now. And I was like, you don't understand me.
The usual adolescent response.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but then it got violent, you know, I didn't know how. So I started.
So you were having difficulty adapting.
Yeah. Well, not to the culture.
Okay.
I just had issues thinking I'm going to get hurt all the time, getting paranoid, you know, you know, not talking about it. Like, I didn't start talking about having this till the last 2 years because I wanted to keep it inside, because culturally that men don't talk about how they feel. You keep it inside.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a man.
Bottle it up.
Yeah. You know, and that's in all patriarchal societies. So we're not pointing finger at one. I'm saying all patriarchal societies that men don't talk about how they feel on the inside. And there's something wrong. I believe it was Sitting Bull. He said the greatest act a warrior can do is kindness, and warriors cry. Mm-hmm. You know, so I was like, you know, this is one of the biggest icons in the world that wanted preached peace and protected people. So I'm looking at, you know, so I started questioning a lot of things. Then during that time, it was a lot of fighting. Then, I was 21. September 11 happened. A lot of racism and hatred. Now, even though I grew up here, you know, I mean, like, you can't, like, a lot of people, they didn't have an image of what an Arab looked like or a Muslim looked like. So they started targeting women, right?
Yes.
And my sisters, and there's times when I lost it. You know, my mother saved across the freaking desert, right?
Five children.
For children, you know, with a week and a half old baby, give or take. And these guys pulled up to her next to a car, high school kids, and like, you know, I would say high school, but they're probably they're older, and they took their t-shirts and did what Beavis and Butthead used to do.
Oh, they put it up and over.
Yeah.
And the cornholio thing or whatever it is. Yeah.
And my mom, you know, is very level-headed. And my little sister was sitting up front, and I was sitting in the back seat. And I got furious. Like, you know, I was like, this is the first time that it's different if I face it myself.
And this was post 9/11?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay.
So it's different if my mom was in line to donate blood, you know, and I want to be clear. Nebraska has very been welcoming to refugees, you know, but I don't know. But it was that one moment when I felt helpless. Like, I can't act out in front of my mother, you know, because I knew better. And I just got mad. And then I started going out and, you know, you go out and you're 21, you're drinking. I was boxing back then. And you feel like nobody can touch you. And people come and say ignorant, racist things. And you get in a fist fight. And one fist fight lead to another fist fight. Now, you know, I never start fight. It wasn't my business. I just wanted to have a good time. Mm-hmm. But people come, you know, and if they hear an accent or if they see your slighter, darker skin, you know, and they were mostly college kids. Now, people in Lincoln, you grow up, but they know you. You know, there were certain bars that we all grew up together. We go there and you hang out all day and nobody. But there were certain bars that were the mostly college kids and they throw something at you or say something that was racist. Then, you know, you're trying to talk it out, right? I mean, as dark-skinned people, we always taught to talk it out before you go out. Because we know we get it's a lose-lose situation.
Right.
It's a lose if you hit them and if you just lose with the police. So it's a double whammy, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I try. And there was times when I got in a fight and the cops go, yeah, we know they're jerks, you know. They were cool about it. They're like, okay, just go home, and they go home. And there was times when I got charged. And then I realized I just don't want to go out anymore. You know, it's like, what's the point of me going out?
Then yeah, all you're doing is just
getting then I realized maybe I should go to lounges. It's better. Let's go to a lounge that you can have a cigar.
Right, go sip a drink.
And sip a drink with older crap. Yeah. And it really changed, you know? So never went back into those crazy bars. And there's some beautiful bars in Lincoln that the community, you know. I mean, Lincoln was beautiful. You know, they had the bars. They were like, you know, Iraqis, Serbians, Bosnians, Russians, African-Americans, black, how people identify. I'm queer. LGBT community, and we were all together in harmony. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody knew everybody. And we, you know, but over time, those business don't last. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's getting gentrified. All these bars are coming in. There's few are standing. And that's the ones, if I go back home, I don't get in trouble with. So that's like the thing that, I grew up. So I got interviewed. So I applied for my U.S. citizenship.
Yeah.
And I interviewed, and the immigration officer, you know, asked me questions about the United States. It was my first education. So I was just sitting there. People were studying for months. I was like, oh no, this is normal. You know, this blah, blah and blah. You know what happened? And she's like, look, you're good. There's a ticket on your record and I would just like you to send me
the documentation,
the police report. Well, two things. I'm really lazy on sending papers on time.
Oh no.
You know, and
so you're an artist at heart.
Always been. And I just kept, you know, pushing it and pushing it. So at fault, I was, you know, certain point. So the immigration officer said, look, I'm leaving soon. Send me the paperwork. And you should be ready to swear in the next few months.
Now, how long had you been on this, as they say, path to, you know, naturalization? How long have you been doing the process?
Well, when I did it, I was 22.
Uh-huh.
And so that was, you know, from 94 to 20, you know. Because when my family applied, I was 18 at the time. They're all, you know, U.S. citizens. So I had to apply out on my own. I postponed it. You know, so I send in the paperwork, I send in the ticket, but it went to the wrong person. And they responded back within a month and they said, no, you are denied your U.S. citizenship because you had poor moral character. And I said, poor moral character. So I went and looked it up. And basically people who sexually assaulted people or sold drugs, convicted of selling drugs. And I was like, well, I'm neither of those.
That's the area they put? Oh, yeah. My God.
So I was neither of those. So I went and I talked to my friends, retired, and they're like, this is ridiculous. They're like, no, you know? So a friend of theirs is an immigration attorney, and I met with him, and he's like, yeah, I've been doing law for 40 years. So my green card was expired at that time because I thought I'm getting my citizenship. So it was like this weird, you know, place to be.
Like a limbo sort of thing. Yeah.
And I was like, look, I don't know where else to go. Neither they can send me anywhere because I don't have any Iraqi citizenship. So I'm like a nomad.
Yeah, a man without a country at this point.
Yeah. And I was like, you know, my brother, you know, was with the U.S. military in Iraq. A lot of my friends were. So I was like, you know, this is home.
I'm very sorry. So I just want to emphasize here, your brother's fighting.
He worked for, private companies with the United States with intelligence.
Okay. You know? Sorry.
So,
I just wanted to
check. Yeah. So yeah, he was collecting intelligence that they, you know, so linguistics intelligence for the U.S. military, but he was working with a contractor that is, highly trusted by the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And here his brother is back in the States. They can't even get a car.
Yeah. And now I'm anti-war. Right.
Yeah.
So I don't believe in wars at all. And, I don't believe, you know, I seen what they could do. And I seen it turns, you know, Don McCollin said like war is a combination of two bad things. And war is, you know, people, you see monsters during that time.
Well, and the reality of it is you're a product of.
Of course.
War of your own.
Yeah. And I'm product actually born in the Iraq and Iran war.
Mm-hmm.
Witnessed the Gulf War, Iraq invading Kuwait.
And evolved into what we're seeing here today.
Witnessed the uprising in I witnessed multiple battles and wars.
Yes.
I would say up to 5 or 6.
Yeah.
Combined. And, but I never lost hope in humanity. And I think that's a lot of my work is based on the goodness in us.
Yeah.
You know, Charlie Chaplin has a good speech, you know, the greatest dictator speech. There is goodness in all of us. And I'm a truly believer in that. So I talked to the attorney and, he was disappointed. So we filed the paperwork and they said, oh no, you're good to have a green card. So I got it within a month.
From that point?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But I was like, well, what's going on? You know, I was confused. And, so I was like, okay, so what am I going to do now? Now my work been always political. I mean, like there is no way out of it. My artwork is political. Mm-hmm. My activism is political. Because I don't have the other. Now when I photograph, I'm neutral. I really don't. I'm there to tell you what I saw. I'm there. I witnessed it. I report it back to you. If I'm standing behind the police line, does not mean I'm with the police. And if I'm standing behind the protesters or in the middle of both, I'm there to tell a story. Mm-hmm. You are a grown up adult or a young artist. Adults can be artists too. You know, you make your own thing. Now, because I find certain things, appealing to me to cover is because I have a certain connection to them, you know?
So that's how you're choosing is kind of like where.
Well, because I believe there are certain things that nobody want to talk about. I did a long story about women giving birth in prison that I didn't publish, but the company I work for working on the documentary. These were young Caucasian women, right?
Mm-hmm.
And their crimes were sad. Literally breaks your heart. And, you know, they get out and I met with them to do follow up. And I was like, hey, how are you? Have you been holding up? And I went to her house. She just paying rent to keep her child. Fridge was empty. You know, and I was like, hey, the company I'm working for is paying for dinner. Let's go get groceries.
There you go.
You know?
Nice. Yeah.
Because, you know, people are like, oh no, you're a journalist. I was like, no, you need to check yourself because you're a human being first.
We had that discussion in the last week. You're always a human being first.
You know, if I see somebody being hurt, I was on Standing Rock reservation and this lady collapsed on the ground. Other journalists, they're like, oh, sweet Lord, the opportunity. She's a diabetic. There is no story, fools. Like, so I had to run across and go get some Kool-Aid. Is it Kool-Aid? No, Tang.
Tang, yeah.
I had to run, like, with all my gear. And people were freaking out. Why is this dude running with all his gear the other way? And there was a little station and I had to run to, you know, I was smart to grab two because when you're running with equipment, you're like dripping all the way.
Yeah.
And I gave the lady Tang, you know, and I was like, look, this person is a diabetic. My mother is a diabetic. I can read the signs. I know how it is. You know, so we worked on the story. about women giving birth in prison, and they have nothing.
And where was that?
That was in Canyon, Colorado, or it's Canyon, Colorado, and however you pronounce it.
And you started with the documenting them before they were out, like while they were
still prisoners. And I met them, and they got out, and I, when I was working inside with them, they're like, "You address them as an inmate," and I was like, "No, no, I know their name. They know my name. I know their name. I'm not gonna call nobody inmate." Right. And the crimes were petty crimes. Uh-huh. She's like, "I was in love, and my boyfriend asked me to take this weed across to state the line. Other person." No, actually, just across before it was legalized.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. And she's like, "Yeah, they caught me a few times and they just put me 4 years in prison and I was pregnant and they, you know." And I was like, 5-6 women, 8-10 women. And you realize, you know, and I was like, "So what's your story about giving birth in prison?" They're like, "Oh yeah. So the hospital there, right, has a room for them, but they do not want the public to know they have a room." Hmm. You see?
In like Denver. A maternity ward of sorts?
Yeah. Okay. Because people who have cash or who are okay in life don't want to know they're giving birth in the same freaking place
right.
that an inmate. I was like, aren't women's struggle is all the same? Mm-hmm. Why would you do that? Aren't you a human being? What makes your baby? So then this system start. What I believe, what your baby, what floor is your baby born?
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And
yep.
She's like, "Yeah, why would you shackle a woman to a bed giving birth?"
That's
so they shackle the feet and they put it around the belly. They have complications.
That's how it happens?
Yep. They put a strap across the belly. They have complications giving birth.
So they think the woman's going to try and, escape while she's giving birth?
And there is an officer standing there watching, invading your privacy. Two, you can only hold your baby for 2 hours. Mm. Then your baby goes. Can you imagine this?
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
Wow.
And this is a cross spectrum of women color, all right? They all go through this door. First door open, they walk in. First door closes, second door opens, they go into that room.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine what treatment you get?
Yeah.
You know, and this is one story of many, many, many stories.
Right, right.
That I cover. And some I publish and sometimes people don't want me, they don't want to pick it up.
Now, Wassam, let me ask you this. You know, cause you've talked a lot about your experiences and everything. How has your collective experience, like starting from Saudi Arabia, going into your issues you've had with immigration and, you know, here, how has that affected the stories that the projects that you undertake?
Well, I can see what, you know, when people say I give voice to the voiceless, they're giving me a voice. Mm-hmm. That's one way. Two, I know how it is when you say marginalized, you know, I think I'm a walking billboard in a lot of ways, but I am blessed. So it's a weird situation, you know, like I was raised by a single mother, right?
Mm-hmm.
7 siblings. So I always tend to do stories about, families who are struggling.
Okay.
That's one thing I'm always interested to. So my, like, if I'm virgin off your question, you know, you can bring me back and sometimes.
No,
reel you back. Go ahead, man. Yeah. That's okay. Yeah. This podcast is just all about rambling. That's what we do.
Perfect. And, but you know, it affected me all, like the refugee camps, the war, empathy and solidarity and compassion. Mm-hmm. You know,
I mean, people in the most, what's the word? A vulnerable state that they can be in.
And, but I don't see, that's the thing is that I've been vulnerable in those situations.
Yeah.
So if you look at, like, not promoting my work, but if you look at it, I'm not interested in making people look vulnerable.
No. It's just the nature of where
course.
They are.
Yeah. And I understand that. I really understand that. Like, I know how it feels to be hungry. I know how it feels to not pay rent. I know how it feels to, I was in Pine Ridge Reservation working on a story and my friend kid, we're living in a FEMA trailer and he's like, "Hey, you want to look at the stars?" And I was like, "Stars?" His ceiling is caved in his bedroom.
Oh, wow.
Then, you know, well, I have a home to go back to in the Midwest, you know, Nebraska, and a roof over my head. But I remember those days living in a refugee camp under the stars for years.
Yeah.
So there is certain things that I understand And I keep understanding and I'm growing as the more I comprehend what I went through as a child, I see that reflecting back in my work.
Mm-hmm.
Look, if you're a religious person or not, that's not my business. But what I'm saying is that the Abrahamic religion is supposed to teach empathy, solidarity, compassion, and love and justice. All other religions preach the same thing. Agnostics, atheists, you know, any other religion. They all say the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in art that has a no purpose. That's me. I believe as me, I've been given this opportunity to do something good in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I want to do with my stories. And a lot of my work come out of my pocket. You know, I'll make a deal here and there. You know, I'll work extra at school. I'll sell one of my old equipment sometimes. I mean, but my work get picked up, you know, but what I want to do is that there is a story to be told. There is people really believe in you. And that I owe to them. Like, mm-hmm. when people open their home and tell you their story, one of my proudest moments, like, and I never published the work. And, you know, I made this mother a promise. I met this lady, Anna Mae Rodriguez, living in Pine Ridge Reservation. And she walks around with a suitcase all the time. And people just don't talk to her. So a friend of mine said, oh yeah, her son was murdered. And nobody would talk to her. And I was like, huh? Why not? She's like, she's my friend and I would like you to meet her. And I was like, yeah, I would love to, but I'm working on a different story. I can't help her. I don't want to make her a promise I can't keep, but let me hear her story. She's like, look, my son was murdered. They told me it was a suicide, but it's impossible. I mean, you look at the case, you look at the way a .357 Magnum, it's impossible for a human being to put it in the back of their skull.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
We don't have that unless you're the Elastic Man from the Fantastic Four.
Yeah. You know? An execution style that can be nothing else.
Yeah. So she said, I reached out to Eric Holder. I reached out to the FBI. I reached out to the ACLU, right? I reached out to, Senator of North Dakota, Senator of, in Utah. I reached out to everybody. The New York Times dropped it. They told they were about to publish it, but something happened and they said no. So something was happening. And I was like, well, I reached out to the company I was working with and they said, no, that's not our story. Then that's the human in you kicks in.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, look, I can do this story for you. I can make you a video and I can give it to you and you publish it. And somebody would answer the call. Like, answer to you. And I went back and I interviewed her for 2-3 days and I shot the video. I took the stills and I think we called it I carry his blood everywhere. So in her suitcase, she had all the evidence. They gave her the splattered brain matter on his shirt, his shoes, his beanie cap, his ID. They closed the case literally. And I did the story and I just went away to go to work on other stories. And 2 years later, she called me. She's like, they reopened the case of my son. They reopened it. They said it wasn't a suicide. It was a murder and they're opening it and they're going to start investigating it. You know, to me, those are the stories that makes me happy.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know what's going to, the outcome of it. You know, she don't carry that suitcase anymore. She's sleeping now. You know, she's sleeping. And she was a very, like, you know, religious woman, you know, and I didn't want to tell her that I'm agnostic, you know, but you know, to her, this has meant the world. She's like,
now she can move on with her life.
Exactly. Stories like that. When I was, in Appalachia, when I did stories, when I did, you know, work on border towns that were Mississippi Delta for a long time.
I saw that one. You had one, the Mississippi Delta and then the Descendants, right?
Yes, yes. That is the story, but I redid that whole body of work now. I just came back. So last time I think I ran into you,
was at the talk.
Yeah, I was in Mississippi. I haven't edited that. And, so I went there too. And, you know, am I a journalist? Am I a human being? So we grow as people. It's easy to pinpoint poverty. It's easy, you know, in Mississippi, man, you look the other way in this rural towns. It's in your face everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there to work for 5 years now, back and forth. But when I first started, so my surrogate mother is from Petersburg, Virginia, African American, and she's a sociologist. So she's like, you need to read about the South. But when I start reading about the South, I got interested in the poverty aspect, right? Mm-hmm. And the family have held them together. But the story is way more complicated than that. Yes. So at first I said, okay, well, these families, their ancestors were slaves. They lived here. They live on the ground. They can't leave. So in a way, I didn't complete the story. So I kept going back and forth over time. Then I learned there is this place called the Coleman Hall on the border of Louisiana and Mississippi. And this family been there over 100 years. As you drive in, there's Confederate flags. Now, this is an African-American community. Mm-hmm. You drive into the woods. Sometimes my stomach starts turning, you know, because you don't know where you're going, you know?
Yeah, right, right.
And yeah. I got to this community and, you know, I get out and, you know, usually I don't pull out my camera. I let people know what I'm doing, right? Because it's a respect thing.
Yeah. Where you're trying to kind of set the tone for the situation.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I cannot tell people what to do.
Right.
But I say, hey, look, this is what I do here. My, you know, now people introduce me. It's always like this. Like the access I get is somebody took me in.
Networking.
Mm-hmm. Yes. yeah, no, that's the truth.
Truth. Yeah.
You know, people get beat up showing up. I mean, if somebody show up to me and say, I want to take a photo, I'd be like, get out of my face.
Right.
I don't know you. Who you work for? You know, what is it going to go? And I worked there about 2 weeks and so basically my website is 2.5 years old. Haven't been updated, so I'm, you know, re-updating everything.
Yeah. You're getting a little bit behind, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Well, because I'm like this guy right here, Jim. I just work. I just work, yeah?
You're a photographer. You're not a web designer or a blogger. Yeah. You're trying to get a story, and then...
And I stayed there 2.5 weeks, and this beautiful community, you know? And I became, you know, that's my people now, mm-hmm. you know? And in the South, your people.
You get close.
Yeah. Yeah. And
the same. It's a Midwestern and Southern thing. It's, yeah. There's a unity.
Yeah. And when you do people right, you keep going back over and over and over. And that's my key thing. I tell to people, I was like, if you feel I'm did. So when I publish the work, I let them know. Mm-hmm. And if I don't give a crap what a photo editor think, I'll take those images out. That's me, because these are my friends now, mm-hmm. right? You build, I don't, like some people say, oh, they're just there, a subject. Okay, and street and journalism is understandable, but when you're doing an extended photo essay or documentary, you build those relationships. You come into people's homes. You eat the sandwiches they eat. You drink the water they drink. I mean, you smoke cigarettes and you tell, they open up to you. And you turn around and betray that trust.
Did you feel a connection between them and what you went through in
oh, your yeah. past? Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Thank you, because I would have kept rambling on. Yes, they lived in trailers, uh-huh. FEMA trailers, propane tanks. You know, I remember we used to stand in lines for hours to get our gas to go cook for our stoves, water being pumped out of the ground. Now, this is America, all right? I just uh-huh. want to be very clear about yeah. this. Water is getting... You know, like the pump, it yeah, goes into yeah, a big yeah. thing. Okay. Those are all there. So that's the community I got to meet. I met a lady. She was blind and deaf. Lost her eyes because of segregation back in the early 50s. She lost it in the 60s. She's in her 70s now. The doctor refused to treat her. Hmm. She lost her eyesight, her ear, like she can't hear anymore. And they live in lowland. So when it floods in Louisiana, they all get flooded.
Underneath yeah. the floodplain, yep.
Yep. And I said, but they don't want to leave. That's you. This home. Is the land. Yeah. Where are they going to go? Who's going to, you know? And so Miss Kim is her niece. And I said, you know, I was like, why don't your aunt come outside? And she said, well, when it flood, we lost the porch. And she's blind and deaf. You know, we have to stand on 2 concrete bricks to get in the house. She got nothing to hold on. I mean, 2 years ago, you with me? People can't build a porch. Now, I come here with my privileged butt, you know, mm-hmm. trying to drink my coffee and my lattes and deciding really what New Balances I should buy. And like, you know, To me, that's privilege when I get an option to choose between two shoe pairs.
Yeah.
Though that's not to say that you didn't come through some shit. No.
To me, everything I own now is a privilege.
Right.
Because you see,
you appreciate it.
I appreciate it. And to me, is that, and I was like, as a journalist, you cannot intervene. But as a documentarian, you can.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that is actually a key in, a documentary. It's all cousins. It's all family. Yeah. Through street documentary journalism. But there are different approaches and different freedoms that you have.
Yeah. So I called my fiance and I was like, hey, listen, can you call any friends you have who would like to donate? I would like, and we went and, with this gentleman named Lemmy Chaplin, he's like the parish constable. Yeah, the parish constable and other people in the community. And I said, look, I can find the funds to build the porch, but I'm a horrible carpenter. So I just want to make this clear.
Yeah.
And they said, look, you get the lumber. They said, what are you good at? And I was like, well, I used to do concrete when I was young. So these are my jobs when I first came to the United States. I used to like concrete, you know, come out of a truck to do a parking lot. Mm-hmm. And they said, good, dig the holes 3 feet deep.
Get the foundation.
And that's your job. And we spent 2 days, you know, and I'm with the, you know, dig
the hole.
And so we built an 8-foot porch, 6 feet long, 8 feet wide. And, you know, to me, that's something.
Yeah.
You know, and people like, we want to throw, the community is like, we want to throw you a barbecue. I was like, no, I'm leaving tomorrow. But now that whole family called me. Email me. One of their sons now moved to Kansas to get a job, and I was talking to him on Facebook. Then he called me on Facebook chat. He's like, "Mom is doing great. Auntie loves the porch, you know." But this is my friends.
Yeah.
Look, the thing is, we're all human beings. We're pack animals. We love one another. I don't care what political views you have. You still love people. You're a human, mm-hmm. right? Yep. It shows in our work.
We're social animals.
Yeah. Reservations, same exact thing. I can't. Remember the last time I went to a place that I had to pay for food, a place to stay, or a car? I don't know. You know, because people remember you. Do right by people, and people do right by you. I don't want to be that documentary journalist that do a story and can never go back and do other stories. Mm-hmm. You know, so, what you get the Times and you get that. That's amazing. But you burn few hundred people just to get your name out there.
Yeah.
That's beyond capitalism. That's like a shark.
Mm-hmm. And then looking at your work, I noticed that you have some projects with one in particular, Rosebud.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about this?
So, yes. Well, it's a drag on. It's going to be a drag on sentence. Okay. So, Native Americans have a history of being exploited by journalists and documentarians, right? So, I wanted to make sure people trusted me. People in Pine Ridge, when I showed up to Rosebud, I said, I know this person and you can contact them and they'll tell you. People do call. And I was there. So Rosebud was like a Standing Rock right now. Not that big, but it was a camp. And it was against the Keystone Pipeline. And they had a camp there. And that's when I talked, I took 11 rolls of film.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the one. Right that's there. The one.
Yep, that was the one.
It's only 11.
You know, and I got there and I just sat and watched, you know, I sat and watched, I introduced myself and I sat and watched and I didn't photograph. People didn't know I was a photographer. My friends who were there photographing, they're like, we don't know you took pictures, because I don't believe I have to photograph all the time. I want to understand what was happening. I had mm-hmm. questions. And, then people like, well, do you have a place to stay? And I said, no. They said, do you have a tent? I was like, no. They're like, what do you have? I was like, look, I have clothes and I have my camera equipment. What you guys got for me? And you know, and people are, and they're like, well, my brother now, it was like, literally, like, we've been friends ever since then. Visit me, visit them. I adopted him. So usually people adopt native adopt people.
This happened when you were there.
Yeah. I adopted Wayaka. He's from Rosebud. That's my younger brother. And,
I would definitely give him a big shout out here.
Yeah. Oh, he's he'll come in to Standing Rock. He's one of the main people.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So I So I was there and I got my, there was like 12 teepees, you know, because it was set up that way. And I got a military card and they said, this is your place. You stay here. And, so then, you know, I just stayed there and I kept working and I kept photographing. Then I kept, you know, working with my friends and keeping in touch. And we're still friends till today. That's the reason I went to Stand in Iraq and did all the work and got all the access I got. Okay. Because of that situation too. So, and I, like, then I did the story and, I went back again two times to visit because I had to come back before I start school. I started school August 2014 and I had to go visit my friends and say, bye. I'm going to move to San Francisco. I'll see you guys soon. But we always keep in touch. Mm-hmm. They always call me or tease me about something, you know, mm-hmm. or I tease them, you know, just to keep in touch. So I did that work in Rosebud and my idea was to photograph people with the land before the Keystone Pipeline, which is gonna, you know, with the new, presidency, there is a
98%
going to happen.
Yeah.
So I have the old images, which is I have to reach out to the agency that I'm sending work to now saying, look, I have work from Rosebud when this happened. And so to make it short, I did the work. I went back. I developed it, you know, so film, I have my own drum scanner, Hoptic drum scanners. I scan my film. I put it up. Then, I moved on to the next project. Then fast forward 2.5 years, I get a call from Wayaka too. And he's like, yo, we talked between the times and, he's like, look, we're standing. We're starting a camp in Sacred Stone Camp. He was one of the original 10 people who started it. Him and the other two people, well, Cheryl is not anonymous anymore, but one of them liked to be, and Cheryl's son, Happy American Horse, and they started one of the founders, LaDonna Iron Horse, I believe that's her land, so she invited them to start against the Dakota Access Pipeline, started there. So Wayaka called me and he's like, hey, you lived in a refugee camp. Any advice how to operate a camp? And I was like, man, it's different circumstances.
It's slightly different, yes.
And I was like, you know, we were joking and, you know, and I was like, so he's like, look, we're starting it. And, but I didn't pay much attention. Yeah. I didn't, because I was in midterms. I was in school. I was working on the story about Mario Woods. He was murdered, in Bayview. Then I was working on a different story about mothers losing their sons to gun violence, but I was more interested what the sons left behind. I was, you know, because it's sometimes hard to go back to do a documentary about somebody that's passing. Yeah. So I was like, what are you holding on to now? Right. Mm-hmm. So that's the new work still coming out. So there's this, all this crazy. Craziness happening. And so I was like, look, brother, it's hard for me to come out to document what's happening, but give me some time. And then out of nowhere, I get a text like, shit, hit the fan, get your ass here. So I bought my ticket because I shoot in a different style too. Uh-huh. And mine is more empowering, right?
Right.
I'm not interested in the altercation. Somebody's trying to choke somebody. There is 600 people photographing that.
Yeah.
But I'm interested in who's building the movement. What are they doing? What are they standing for? You know, because this is what makes history. Anybody can stand there like, ah, you know?
Yeah. You know what? There was some, you just touched on something I was about to ask you.
Yeah.
You mentioned at Rosebud and then you talked about this where it was important. It is not necessarily important to have the camera in your hand all the time, at least and initially. Talk about that, you know, because talk about trying to build a connection.
Yeah. So I have a big mouth, you know, and I'm like walking around and just talking to people. I just talk to people. That connection is important because people want to talk to you too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is big. I'm not saying big cities don't have that connection, but here everybody's busy with their lives. They don't want to talk to other people, but there people talk to one another. They actually remember your name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they remember what cigarettes you smoked with them last time.
Yeah.
And what you ate. So we just sit there and talk. You know, they're interested in my story. I'm interested in their story. We share stories, laughters and, you know, happy stories, sad stories, crazy stories. So you build that connection. So when you photograph that person, you know, in the protest 5-6 days from whatever, they're at ease with you. They're themselves. Mm-hmm. Everybody.
There's a genuineness.
Yeah. It's like everybody went that protest when everybody's like, You know?
Yeah.
And there was shots, I think I haven't been, there was this thing. So during the Dakota Access Pipeline, they did this thing, 25 arrests were in for John Doe's and Jane Doe's. But I know some of those folks and I got access to photograph them in certain ways that other journalists or documentarians didn't have the privilege. Mm-hmm. They were basically a lot of people who started getting the work there that, you know, that work there that people introduce you. And remember, I mean, like, I'm being selfish telling my story, but the bigger struggle is the activists and the people on the ground who are fighting every day and doing so much work.
Right now, as we speak,
yeah.
As you're listening to this podcast.
Of course, and they're doing more than I can ever do.
Yeah.
But I'm planning on going there too. School to get out December 9th. I'm planning on going back there. And please, if you're listening, support that. You know, it don't matter what energy you believe in. I do. I know you believe in water.
Yeah.
You know?
It's kind of the whole point or the origin of life.
Yeah. And you know, and the natives are not fighting for them. That's what people think. They're fighting for you and me and all of us.
Yes, because this pipeline goes through a number of different water, springs. This is
it's going to go down the Mississippi River.
Yep.
I mean, and it's going to go down.
I grew up on the Mississippi and, you know, there's always been the old running joke.
It didn't affect
the muddy Mississippi, but there's a big fucking difference between mud and oil.
Yep.
Yeah.
And there's a big difference between 10 million people who have to buy bottled water now.
Right, right. And right now it's very easy to have your focus all on the political side of things, but don't lose sight of all of the issues that are going on. This one, you know, we all just got kicked in the gut and there is a significant issue going on with the racism, with the xenophobia, but this election has not changed or stopped the protests going on in the Dakotas.
No, not at all.
That is still happening, folks.
Yesterday, somebody came with a pistol, and I know those activists. And I would, look, let me be very clear, and I would put my name behind this and my career. You know how sometimes people are like, oh, you didn't witness that. When I was there the 3 weeks and I went back again for 4 days, nobody had a gun, nobody had a freaking weapon. Now people had axe to chop wood. Yeah, the young man's purpose is to serve the older people, mm-hmm. right? And nobody wanted violent there. Man, there were so many people there from every walk of life. There's natives, white, gay, Arab. I seen Muslim women with hijabs there. African Americans, Latinos, Russians, Scandinavians, people were there.
And not to interject, but also varying different tribes.
Of course.
That's something to not forget.
There's over 200 some. And you know what? Nobody treated you different. Nobody looked at your skin color or your status in life. You were part of this and you eat with everybody. People don't want to leave because this is one, some of the first times in their lives. They're being acknowledged as people. And you see people hanging out, you just come and have your, just eat. There is like 6 big kitchens and not one kitchen say you cannot eat with us.
Mm-hmm.
There is not one kitchen that said we will not give you tent tonight or we will not give you a sleeping bag tonight. I mean, people want to go there because it's a large community. There is people from different political views there.
Right.
Yeah.
There is, I think over 100 some veterans there. Veterans
mm-hmm.
who fought in the Gulf War, Korea, Vietnam, this wars. They have veteran tents. There was hundreds of veterans there marching in solidarity and with the pipeline. There's everybody.
This is an issue that goes far beyond just, like we were talking about, just the reservation. This is not just a singular, isolated mm-hmm. deal. This is something that is going to affect masses of people.
I mean, Nebraska will be affected. Iowa will be affected.
Hugely.
The Missouri River runs off. Mississippi River runs off. They're all going to be affected. So they need to get off that. All right. I mean, really, there is a journalism and documentarians and there is real logic.
Mm-hmm.
And the real logic is we're all going to get fucked up if there is no water. You know, farmers who are not, where are you going to get your water from? You know,
mm-hmm.
Taking a shower, brushing your teeth. Trying to wash your stinky butt, you know?
It's far beyond partisan politics.
No, really. Yeah, like, yeah. Okay? And you need to realize that water is important. I mean, you know.
Hell of a lot more important than oil.
Yeah, Minnewakani, water is life. Okay? You want to have your fancy beer or your IPA? Right?
Water.
Water. I like
beer.
I like PBR, you know, the shitty $3 tall boy. Okay, that's just me. I was been a cheap beer drinker. You know, people get mad that they're like, fancy beer. I was like, no, I like the cheap one.
I was not expecting that.
Yeah, no, I am. I'm one of those people. Yeah, I like whiskey fancy, but, you know, good one. But
you don't have the hipster beard or anything with PBR.
No, because I like cheap beer. I mean, I don't care what people think. 2 PBR for $6 set me straight.
This is true.
When I pay $14, I need 4 of those. I'm broke at the end of the night. You know, I still calculate life and film prices, like a roll of film prices. Yeah, you know? Yeah. And there is a lot to talk about.
That's the interesting thing about right now is that the amount of things to talk about.
There's too much.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
And you have to find a focus point on. The good thing is that photojournalism, documentary photography is not gone. It's not going anywhere.
This is going to be our prime time.
Yeah. There are cell phones. There are, and we can argue the who is who of journalists and who is a photographer and who's not. The fact of the matter is all of the, there is too much to talk about, but there's enough of us to cover it all.
Man, I think we need at least more. Here's the thing. There is enough cookies to be shared, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have 4 years of, look.
Yeah, the next 4 years is going to have plenty of story.
Yeah, look, we talk about the 60s and we talk about the 30s and we talk about the 70s and we talk about all, the civil rights movement, feminist movement, anti-war movements.
Civil rights and suffrage
We're going to live in our time now. Yeah. You know, a lot of people like, I wish I got, the Robert Frank photographs, or I wish I got the Eugene Smith Vietnam War or the Dorothea Lange,
It's time to create your own.
It's time to make our own.
The next Robert Frank?
Because during their time, they, look at how long it took them for their work to be acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this is our time right now. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't think I'm going to be one of those big names, and I don't want it to be. I just want to do my own thing and my own
confidence
thing
confidence.
Yeah. No, I'm confident in myself, but I don't, I just want to do my work.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that pays off. I think the ones who want to like be the running horse, they're going to be winded first.
Mm-hmm.
Just be cool and do your own work and see how it goes.
I want to talk about another one of your projects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the portraits of the Iraq War refugees.
Yeah. That was my first one.
That was your first one. Yeah. Tell them how did that come about?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story and then I'll tell. So the idea was this. I wanted to be a photographer, but I didn't want to be a digital photographer. I wanted to be a real one now, all you.
Real photographer.
I know. You know, yeah.
Perception.
Be naive.
Man.
Yeah, I know.
No, I felt that way. I felt the same way.
Yeah, and I was like, you know what? All these digital mofos, they shoot too much, think too little. And I don't want to be that. I'm Sam, right? I don't know where I got that idea from. I must have been drinking one night and I came up with it.
Like, no. Too much PBR, man.
Yeah. I was like, I'm going to be film and film only. And so I bought me a Contax G2.
Mm-hmm.
So funny story too. I wanted the rangefinder, but out of focus. So I was always trying to find the shortcut because my friend gave me a Contax, three, the old manual and another one had the Nikon S3. And I was like, well, yeah, that's cool, but I want the out of focus, And that's what I used.
Even whenever you wanted to be a real photographer, you're still seeking things leaning more toward the digital age.
Yeah. In all reality, rangefinders are not digital focus, But I was like, but I think what sold me the Contax lenses and all of that.
Which are amazing.
Amazing. And, so at that point, I was in a struggle, Tri-X or, Fuji.
Mm-hmm. HP5. Yeah.
And so I decided with Tri-X. Been my film ever since then. No preference. I just love it because it's easy for me because I've developed my own system with it. And I kept reaching out. Well, I'll bring him up. He's an amazing, his father was actually Life Magazine master printer.
Hmm.
Like everybody's work.
Who's this?
Lenny Iger. He lives in Petaluma.
Okay.
Now very successful in the days. I mean, master printer till today. You guys should know him. And I was like, look, I want to do this portrait series, right? And I did it behind the garage, and I bought a scrim, like a 12 by 12 scrim to diffuse the light.
Mm-hmm.
And, I spot mirror the faces and I let everything blow up because then I was like, I can pull it, you know, like overexpose it to stop and underdevelop it to, you know,
yeah.
And pull that crap, system, you know? So, and I didn't want to invert film, you know, in a can. I bought me a Drupal processor. So I like that stuff. I make my work 10 times longer. Right. I don't know why. That's maybe I haven't developed film for a whole 6 months lately. Now, so that project go into it and I'll come, you know, so I wanted to pay homage to the woman who fled the war and who saved 42 children combined.
Uh-huh.
And the little girl who held the box, her father was actually sent to the execution field that days and, that day in Iraq, and the sergeant or the commander of the execution said, I'm at quota for the day, get out of my face. So that story resonates with her telling her father's story.
Now, these are people that are bringing you items in relation to yes. their yeah. experience.
The only person who couldn't bring items was my mother. She's like, I had 5 little puppies around me. She's like, what am I going to put you guys all in this picture? I was like, no, that's fine. You know?
But that was the concept of the project.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
For people to bring these things.
Yes, and so I went to different stories, women who lived in different refugee camp, and I seen them strong and resilient. I didn't see the war break them, mm-hmm. you know, and I wanted to photograph them in that manner.
Okay.
And so I did the project, and they picked a big round, like, you know, when internationally got published in 34 different countries. Then it got published here, then I got exhibitions, but I don't like that. That wasn't me. I was not after that. So I just disappeared. For like a year and a half, I just avoided anything.
Hmm.
Because that's not me. I'm not out there to get me out there. I was out there to get the story out there.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be the blah, blah, with some speak for that. I was like, no.
The spotlight turned on you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then I gave talks and people came up to me and they're like, oh, you're very liberated. I was like, huh?
Then, like, you got people going, hey, come on my podcast or something.
No. Actually, podcast wasn't popular back then. They were just picking up.
You know? I'm talking about now.
This is photography podcast, so it's different.
True. There you go. That's
at
good
least
point.
You're giving me the chance to talk about photography.
So
I shot the film and I was like, I'm going to go downstairs and develop it. There's a lot, you know, mm-hmm. if you're going to know me, I make more mistakes than I make good. So
don't we all?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, so I was like, you know, this is my first time mixing film. So I bought a bottle of HC-110 and I poured it just directly on one roll of film. Just like, and I was like, you know, how is film cheap? This is crap. I'm pouring a bottle of film into this little container. I just lost $8. So there's a really well-known photographer who used to live down the street by my house named Don McCollin. And so I went knocking on his house. Not the British one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. No, wait a minute. You lived down the street for hell?
No, not that one. So I knocked on his door. He used to do a lot of landscape and he worked for DC. He was well-known in the 80s and he just retired.
Okay.
Don Cunningham.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Correcting. Yeah. Right. I was talking about McCollin earlier because of the war thing. And I was like, hey, Don, he's like, what happened? What happened to your film? It's so dense. Can't see nothing. And I said, I know. That's what I'm trying to figure out. He's like, okay, well, Sam, tell me your process. I was like, well, I took the film, put it in the container, and I poured the whole bottle of HC-110. He goes, well, yeah, there you go. You're supposed to mix it, like dilute it 1:40 or something. You know? Then I learned through my mistakes. So uh-huh. I developed the film, I scanned it, and I printed them out. So that was the point of the project, to pay homage and to pay respect to them. And my mother was in it. And then later on, when ISIS took over, UNHCR in Italy reached out to me saying, can we use one of the images to fund money for, you know, women and like young girls? And I said, sure. They're like, how much you want to be paid? I said, zero. Take the money you want to pay me and throw it into...
back into the campaign organization. Uh-huh.
I was like, because I can't charge people for that kind of work.
Yeah.
It's like, how can I want to speak for, you know, the marginalized and the oppressed and want to collect money? The world don't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I'm a refugee myself. So it's like me trying to hustle another refugee.
Yeah.
So that's the project I worked on. And I think I'm going back to restart it, because now there's new refugees coming in.
Exactly.
But this time approaching it in a complete different way. So I have a new way of going about it, and I'm hoping to do it.
Seeing your work and seeing what you've provided across multiple different projects is an inspiring thing. And I wish that more people would go and take a look at what you have going on, what other documentary photographers are putting mm-hmm. together right now, because in this time and space, there's an exponential increase on those that are covering.
Yep.
And which is great. It's like we talked about at the opening of the show is, the more the better, because the more issues that there are, the more things to talk about. We need more voices to be able to talk about it rather and document it. And that's why I'm so glad you've been on the show here today to tell your story and talk shop with us. You know, whenever we got off into it,
I get happy.
exactly. But now one of the things that I always want to do, that I always ask our guests, if there was any place in the world that you haven't been, your dream place, is there anywhere that you want to go and shoot?
Yeah, I want to. Well, not one. My goal is after I graduate is to cover wars.
I want to jump into that.
No, that's my thing. But I'm interested in the aftermath,
mm-hmm.
in a way, uh-huh. like what happened to people. There is a lot of war journalists, so I want to cover. My goal is to cover wars 3-4 years. Like, don't come back home.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I don't know how my fiance gonna feel about that, but just cover wars for 3-4 years, you know, and in the sense of to do the right thing, to help people, to get their stories out, to shed light on things and the aftermath of war, the consequences that the victims have to live with. Mm-hmm. The victimizers always move on to bigger positions, different countries, you know.
Like lobbyists?
Yeah, actually, they're like.
Well, the journalists too.
Yeah.
You know, the journalism in general, you know, print or, you know, mm-hmm. They move on.
Yep.
They move on to the next conflict. Yeah, exactly. They forget about the aftermath.
Yeah. And that's the sad part. Yeah.
And a lot of us are guilty of that.
Yeah. There is at least 20 little wars that are happening right now, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Sudan, southern Sudan and northern Sudan, there is a lot of things happening there. Libya, people think Libya's over?
Just quieted down because it's not top story anymore.
Yeah, I've been duking it out for so long.
Mm-hmm. So these things are not going away.
No, there's so much happening. Just the media is not interested anymore because don't let the media fool you. You know, like don't let them fool you. They have they want to sell airtime and they want to sell, you know, television. I mean, we look at personalities on TV now.
Yeah.
We vote
for personalities on TV now.
You know, yeah. I mean, you got a personality on TV making 30, 40 million, whatever a year, and you got a school teacher making 30 grand, 40 grand trying to make it. What the hell is a reality TV or a personality on a news channel is committing or contributing to society comparing to somebody that's grooming like a tree into becoming something that bears fruit for the future? There is a good book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. It talks about television. I highly recommend that. I forget it. Neil Postman. This been big since the 80s. I mean, he wrote the book in the 80s. Post communication professor, I think at NYC, if I'm not, or either NYC or Columbia. And I'm using ourselves to death. And, this is nothing new. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were talking about presidents giving advice to each other about losing weight to win president elections.
Back then.
A president called another one to give them advice if they want to run. I'm using ourselves to death.
The reality is that we do look at each other as some odd products.
Yep.
But so is there any particular place?
I want to start in my own country.
Okay.
My birthplace. Yeah, I mean, you know, I can't be a revolutionary and I'm not going to speak up there.
True.
I mean, my goal is to start there, go to the border, cross the ocean into Europe. I mean, the migration whole process to do it. You know, but I thought about that, or I thought about even going with my passport as a refugee and just cross it and experience it and photograph it and go through the process. But with that, the place is known that I'm a journalist or a documentarian.
Mm-hmm.
None of that. So maybe, I don't know, you know, I mean, I don't think that's issuing them the least going to stop for the next 4 or 5 years. So that's when people say, don't you go? Why don't you go yet? I was like, because it's always been like this. I've been here in this world 32 years.
There's no deadline.
No, They've been going for 32 years. Iraq been in wars and battles and overthrow and underthrow and this and that since I was born. Mm-hmm. And it was like that before I was born.
Yeah. Well, as far as for that project and any that you've already completed, where online can people find out more about
you? Well, my website is just wassamalbadri.com. Maybe you can link.
We'll link it into we'll link it in show notes too.
Yeah, and they can, you know, and if any advice I can help you with, I mean, you know, I'm more than happy. Any information, I really like. I don't mind sharing information because I think there is enough in the world. I'm already with some people who I send my work to, so you know, if you need an email for somebody or if something, I can help you. You know, don't hurt me. And in the future, I just ask you to help somebody else. Like the favor got to be returned for a favor.
Pay it forward. Yes. That's exactly.
A perfect mantra. Pay it forward.
Yep. Well, you're published, right? You're published.
I've been published.
Yeah.
Well, so I started with CNN. Then I worked for a company called Timeline Production. Then I worked for Al Jazeera America. Those are the ones I've been published with. Mm-hmm. Now I'm sending my work to a photo agency, Contact Photo Agency.
Okay.
It's one of the oldest independent ones still, started. It's pretty much you own all the rights. There was Magnum and there is Contact. Yeah. So I'm submitting my work there. I'm not with them. They just been taking it. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, mm-hmm. my goal is, I have a show coming up, I believe, at SF Camera Work. Then I have a show in Berkeley about activism, hashing out the things. And I think I'm doing it. Faisal Sheikh is coming to Photo Alliance, SFAI. There's a talk that's happening. I'm going to be part of that. So there's a lot of things that I'm doing slowly, but I also have to focus on getting my degree.
That's my biggest thing.
Yeah. And,
we're going to need an RSS feed just to keep up on your project.
Yeah. I'm running all over the place, but next semester, my goal is not to intern for anybody. Doing two internships right now with all my work. So I'm trying to like cut that out and just focus on me or my work to get it out. But right now, last publication was a Swedish magazine I went to do the work in Standard Rock for called Udfront. And they do mostly human rights. They won awards about like human rights. And so basically they're like human rights watch in a way, but they do work about human rights issues. Good customers. I mean, in the sense of letting me have freedom about writing my own story to tell what happened, translate into Swedish. But with that,
it's not a common freedom. I guess reach.
But Contact Photo Agency gives you that complete freedom. The images are yours. That the last photo agency that the photographer have complete freedom. And complete support.
That's music to my ears, dude. Hear that still.
Well, Sam, do you have any dates for the SF Camera Works exhibit?
I believe they will all be mid-June, July of next year because they're planning them ahead of time. I can email you guys.
Yeah,
I think you guys should, and your listeners should be part of Photo Alliance. Been in the Bay 15 years. They brought every major photographer, big name.
Mm-hmm.
They still continue. Yesterday, Richard Moss, they brought him. He did about juvenile justice in prisons. They have a large community of photographers. They pretty much, if you have a big name photographer that you can't really go see, they end up bringing them.
Yeah.
And you talk to them one-on-one. Like, there's 100 people show up at the end of the night, you just kick it, you know, and you have a conversation with this. I met Eli Reed there.
Mm.
I blew it, you know, I was like, hey man, I like her work in Iraq. He goes, no, I worked in Beirut. Then I was like, yeah, same thing. After he signed my book for me. Because I got them mixed up, you know?
Oh, my God.
I mean, there's amazing.
Eli Reed.
Yeah. And he's funny, you know? He's like, no, man, I worked in Iraq. And I was like, no, he's like, I was like, oh, it's cool, man. I'm from Iraq. Can you sign my book for me? I signed it. I was like, I better get out of here before he called me out and make fun of me.
Right.
Because he got that sense of humor. He was funny. Yeah.
Well, cool. So, well, Jim, where can we find out more information about you there, bud?
As always, jimwatkinsphoto.com, and all my social media platforms are right there.
Yep. Perfect. Yep. And I highly recommend looking at Jim's work. He puts my work to shame in a way with so much work. Jeez. It's amazing.
Yeah,
no, seriously.
I throw out a whole lot of crap.
That's no, what it is.
I'm watching Jim's head just start swelling.
No, because it's those moments, you know, like those moments you capture people. That's what I saw. And I was like, man, please God, don't make me and him have a talk about our work tomorrow. I really did. I was like, look, I'm not prepared to have the conversation with Jim, how he shoots and how I shoot. And I was like, so I'm glad you know that you're the host. I didn't have to deal with you talking about my work.
It's not about me.
It's amazing. Amazing. And Casper, yeah. I think you have your website too.
Yep. That's going to be recasper.com. Yep. You'll find more information there. I have been covering the Oakland protests. There's a lot of protests because the Bay Area, you have SF, you have Oakland, you have Berkeley. There's even going down in South Bay. But for me, I chose Oakland. And so you're going to find a lot of imagery there. The first night that everyone knows about, the ninth, whenever things went a little sideways, as an understatement, by those very unfortunate few, the troublemakers. But I went out there and documented the after effects of that around midnight, 1 a.m. So that was the first post. And then now I've got active photography of the protest. So you can find that at recasper.com. You can find all of my social media there. Jim, you say?
I was just going to say that Oakland stuff was amazing.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah. I really got jealous in a way when I was like, yeah.
Oh,
I saw him. Uh-huh. No, I was like, he got the aftermath. Uh-huh.
Because it's gone now.
Because, you know, Jim's natural. You know, Jeff Nakwe, like the aftermath, right? Because it's the city is empty, is dead, like you mentioned earlier, right? Because see, you don't need people to speak.
Nope.
And you did that. The image spoke for themselves.
Yes. And it was interesting walking those streets. And because at first I was, I'll be honest, I was upset and regretful that I didn't make to document the protest itself. Uh-huh. Because of how historic it was. But when I got into town and started taking those shots, I was very quickly reminded of how important that is.
Yep.
But
yep.
You can find that information there. I also have a recap, about the night. And above all, take a look at streetpx.com. You're going to find out a lot more about our show there. You're going to find all of our old episodes and that list is growing. Like I said, we're on episode 28 right now. And we just keep on just expanding,
right.
Don't we?
Yeah. Yeah, we sure do, man. You know, we keep getting guests like Wassam here, man.
No, it's a gift for me to be with y'all, to be honest.
Yeah. We're just kind of going down a whole bunch of paths. And I know things have been a little different with our show and the things we've been covering, but it seems that's what everybody wants to hear.
Mm-hmm.
It's the things that are important. You know, we're not caring about gear and gear talk. And
yeah, we didn't bring up gear at all.
No, we
talk about no brands or no nothing.
We're talking about what's important.
Yep.
You know, really. You know, and it's all about, you know, what the photographer is feeling behind the camera.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not necessarily the thing that he has in his hand.
Nope.
That's not the most important thing.
I agree with you.
I don't walk up to a mechanic and go, you know what? Thank you for fixing my car. How about those Craftsmen?
Snap-on.
Or Snap-on. I don't give a shit what kind of wrench it is as long as it don't break.
It's more important than what's in that brain matter.
But, you know, I think that matters a lot, like in studio, like, you know, the high-end studios, what equipment they use. Mm-hmm. But street, no.
Mm-mm. No.
Documentary, like, no, because you don't want to lose your equipment, you know, you get hit.
Nope.
Yeah.
So you use what you got. Like, when you a pen and a pencil, you make magic. Mm-hmm. Like, think about it. You know, the world is the paper and the pencil is your camera.
Pen and paper has changed the world multiple times.
Yep. You know.
So go ahead and take a look at Street PX. You're also going to find us in social media on our Facebook page. But most importantly is a Street PX lounge. Go there. Talk. Let's communicate. If you have anything you want to say, which I'm sure with a topic like this and how the discussion went today, there's plenty of people with plenty of things to say. Feel free to do so.
Yeah.
Good or bad.
Yeah. Don't get hateful. That's not our intention here. We want a discussion just like we've had. And, check that out. Check us out on Patreon. That's where you're going to be able to help us keep the mics hot and the lights on. We got some great, patrons here recently, and our thanks and appreciation go out to you. So if you want to give back to us and help support the show, go to, patreon.com/StreetPX, and you can give $1, give $5, whatever you want to do. We appreciate it all the same. That said, thank you again so much for being on the show.
You're so welcome. Thank you guys for having me.
Wassam, man, we appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you guys, and to the listeners, this was done with much love, and it's just people talking photography and politics. I don't know what side of the spectrum we stay on. We're just talking.
Yep.
So don't be hateful.
Yeah.
just pick up that camera and put it to work.
Yep.
Yep.
All right. Thank you all. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you,
sir. Thank you, Casper. Thank you, Jim. It was a pleasure having me on your show. Did I say it backwards?
That's all right. Doesn't matter, man.
It was a pleasure having you on the show.
Well, I mean,
it was a pleasure for you to have you.
It's a pleasure for me for you guys to have me on the show.